South. I've been called on that pronunciation before.
Yeah, when I was here.
Yeah. Was recently announced as the Kentucky Historical Society's Book of the Year. Congratulations, Bob. He is currently working on a non-traditional political biography of William Goebel. And welcome back.
Take note of the way that Mark pronounced Goebel. Wasn't sure how to pronounce Breathitt, but he knew how to pronounce Goebel. I'm just going to introduce everybody right up front, and then we'll go from there. First, we'll have Professor Michael Ryan of Urbana University in Urbana, Ohio. Mike received his PhD from the University of Cincinnati under Dr. Wayne, does he pronounce it Durrell or Durrell?
Durrell.
I've been saying Durrell all these years, who was his advisor. He has published articles in the Ohio Valley History, American 19th Century History, and the Journal of Social History. And he has an article forthcoming from the Register of the Kentucky Historical Society, so everyone be looking for that. He is currently revising his manuscript, Terror is at Hand, Race, Violence, and Politics in Post-Emancipation Kentucky. And I believe Mike is shopping for a publisher currently, right?
I am currently back on the market.
Okay, good. So keep that in mind. Next, we'll have Brian Alberts. Brian is a PhD student just north of here at Purdue. He is in the early stages of a dissertation project which will examine the growth of American capitalism and market relations throughout the 19th century as seen through the alcohol-related industries. I have a grad student back at UT who should talk to you sometime soon. Not for drinking, but for the subject. Maybe both. Particularly brewing and distilling, so I guess no fermenting. He researches how developments in the production and consumption of alcohol reflect the ways that evolving conceptions of the market, technological development, and transnational networks work to alter American society. Now, I suppose he'll be defending that pretty soon, right? Okay. And finally, we have the Filson's own Jim Pritchard. Jim is a native of Dayton, Ohio. And he received his bachelor's and his master's from Wright State University. He has contributed articles to the Civil War Times, North and South, and True West magazines, in addition to co-authoring a history of the 10th Kentucky's Cavalry, which was Confederate Union. He has contributed entries and essays to such works as the Kentucky Encyclopedia, the Encyclopedia of Louisville, Biographical Dictionary of the Union, Heidler's Encyclopedia of the American Civil War, the World Encyclopedia of Slavery, Confederate Generals of the Western Theater, Kentuckians in Gray, I have a copy of that one, and Virginia at War, 1863. He is the former research room supervisor at the Kentucky Department for Libraries and Archives in Frankfort, and I believe that might be where we actually met once. And he currently works in here in the Special Collections Department at the Filson. So, with that, take it away, Mike, please.
Thanks, Bob. And you know how to pronounce Ryan.
To some extent, yeah.
To some extent. It is not Ryan.
Oh, it's Ryan.
It's Ryan.
Oh, let's see here. Pull a George Washington. I've not only gone gray in the study of Kentucky, but I've also gone blind. Following his election in 1863, Governor Thomas Bramlett petitioned to Washington both for payment of public and private reparation claims resulting from Morgan's raids and for support in raising a large state militia to defend against any further such raids. Additionally, Bramlett personally asked for Stephen G. Burbridge, a brash 32-year-old Scott County slaveholder who had proven himself a capable field officer, to be appointed as commander of the Military District of Kentucky. But by September of 1864, no payment of claims was forthcoming, and Bramlett had lived to regret his endorsement of Burbridge. In a strident letter to President Lincoln, he laid out his principal complaints. In doing so, he alienated himself from both Burbridge and the Lincoln administration for the rest of the war. We are for the restoration of our government throughout our entire limits, regardless of what may happen to the Negro. we reject as spurious the unionism of all who would make the status of the Negro a sine qua non to peace and unity. We are not willing to imperil the life, liberty, and happiness of our own race and people for the freedom or slavery of the Negro. To permit the question of the freedom or slavery of the Negro to obstruct the restoration of national authority and unity is a bloodstained sin. Well, Bramlett went on to complain about the unequal burdens placed on Kentucky. In short, Bramlett represented the interest of many loyal Unionists who were highly frustrated with federal policy regarding the status of Kentucky slaves. This is my old friend here. It's particularly useful when I'm lecturing on Charles Sumner and Preston Brooks. Following on the heels of the Second Confiscation Act, Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, although it did not apply to Kentucky, set a precedent for federal interference with slavery. Perhaps believing that Lincoln, in the form of federal troops being stationed throughout the Commonwealth, was trying to liberate them, growing numbers of Kentucky slaves began voting with their feet, flocking to Union lines, particularly to the military camps throughout the Bluegrass. Some commanders rigorously turned them away, others welcomed any and all runaways and defiantly vowed not to return them to slavery. Indeed, some federal officers seemed to believe that the liberation of slaves was a major component of their mission in Kentucky, a state at least some of them deemed part and parcel to the South. Both slave owners and slave hunters followed regiments from Michigan, Illinois, and elsewhere, trying to regain their property, even as troops sought to shield known runaways from both civilians and local authorities. To the further ire of Bluegrass slaveholders, in August 1863, orders were issued for impressing some 6,000 slaves from central Bluegrass counties to work on the ongoing railroad projects in the area. These slaves, all male from age 16 to age 45, were to make their way to Camp Nelson, and from there they would be organized into work gangs. As the project got underway, it began to morph. Actually, much of the work went on south of the Bluegrass as they attempted to link the central Bluegrass to Knoxville, which was not going to be an easy task. Furthermore, some slaves became drovers, wagoneers, and they wind up all the way down in Tennessee, and Kentuckians are furious about this, that their slaves who are supposed to work locally, and they didn't want to give them up anyway, now are being sent down to Tennessee. In the confusion of all of this, some slaves actually start getting paid wages as wage laborers, and they begin to find opportunities to become free in this process. Well, the federal government also began recruiting black troops in 1863, although Kentucky received an exemption. Initially, many slaves in southern and western Kentucky counties found that they could simply run away to occupied parts of Tennessee. Slaves in other counties could cross the Ohio and enlist in Indiana or in Ohio. In the central Bluegrass, it was a little tougher for them, but recruiting officers in neighboring states appear to have readily accepted slaves from Kentucky into their camps to meet their recruitment quotas. Some white Kentuckians at this time, especially non-slaveholders without the means to avoid the draft, look favorably on black enlistment, on the other hand, figuring that that would be a way they could avoid enlisting in a war that as... my mind just went blank. Used to teach at Kentucky... As Bill Freeling has pointed out, a large number of white Kentuckians seem to have not wanted any part of this war, and so I refer you to his book, South versus the South. Well, pressure built within Kentucky to allow recruitment of black slaves. Also, Bramlett and other prominent Kentuckians spoke out against it, particularly Frank Wolford. Some of you know his story much better than I do. In March 1864, Congress, apparently of a mood not to continue handling Kentucky slaveholders with something akin to kid gloves, simply amended the Enrollment Act to include slaves in the draft. Thus, this cleared the way for full-scale recruitment in the Commonwealth. Burbridge himself was reluctant to begin recruiting slaves. Initially, most slaves were recruited in western Kentucky. They would become part of fort garrisons in the Mississippi Valley. But in April 1864, he slowly began opening the door to recruitment throughout the Commonwealth. White Kentuckians had not been forthcoming in sufficient numbers to fill the quotas, and that meant the specter of a draft. If you can't meet the quotas, the government's going to impose a draft. If the draft is imposed, you may have draft riots on your hand, and that sort of chaos that had been seen elsewhere. So, attempting to appease slaveholders while still opening up for black recruitment, Burbridge proposed a limited recruitment policy. Only slaves with specific permission would be allowed to enlist. Slaves who showed up without proof of permission to enlist would be sent back home, either to obtain it or to go back to work on the farm. All black enlistees would count toward county quotas, a happy note to the numerous white Kentuckians, as I said, who wanted no part of Lincoln's war. Assistant provost marshals would oversee the process, make sure that Kentucky slaveholders had no cause for complaint, and they would be duly compensated for the slaves they allowed to enlist, the slaveholders. Finally, all new black recruits would be quickly removed from the Commonwealth. They would be mustered in and moved elsewhere for training and equipping, thus sparing white Kentuckians the terrible sight of seeing armed black men marching through their communities. Well, by May, many runaway slaves who attempted to enlist were being returned to their masters because they did not have adequate proof. Provost Marshall down in Lebanon in Marion County reported that a group of some 17 African Americans were turned away from the recruiting office in that town. They were given passes to ensure their safe passage back to their farms. Nonetheless, they came under attack by a mob of local citizens who, quote, seized them and whipped them, most unmercifully, with cowhides. Similarly, reports from Nelson and Spencer County stated that some African Americans had been severely beaten and a few had been killed for trying to enlist. Finally, the provost marshal reported that even ostensibly loyal Kentucky troops, namely the 13th Kentucky Cavalry, had openly opposed efforts to recruit black soldiers. At one point, this same provost marshal had actually come under fire from a would-be assassin, a portent of things to come in the southern bluegrass. He noted, quote, the treatment of the slaves in Kentucky during the summer of 1864, the indignities offered the executors of the law of the land, the denunciations of the president, and the machination of slaveholders for the benefit of treason during the same time admirably exemplified the barbarities of slavery. For his part, Burbridge quickly amended his policy, and by June 64, virtually any young male slave who made it to a recruiting station was received. Many Kentuckians still remember Burbridge as a dictatorial, cold-blooded brute. In reality, he seems to have been an unconditional unionist who did everything in his power to prosecute the war to a successful conclusion, as did a number of other loyal Kentuckians. Although he attempted to protect slavery initially, he became enraged at what he considered disloyal behavior on the part of numerous slaveholders. Additionally, he recognized the vast untapped military resource embodied in Kentucky's slave population, a resource that would allow him to protect his native state from the draft and thereby try to preserve some semblance of peace in his military district. By late summer, approximately 14,000 black recruits had enlisted under Burbridge's policy. By his war's end, that number would swell to nearly 24,000, which is a huge, huge percentage. Kentucky's total slave population was only about 200,000, and you eliminate half of those as being women, and then half of that half as being probably underage or overage. then you begin to see what we're talking about here. A huge number of young men enlist, seeing this as an avenue to freedom and a chance to fight to destroy slavery. Well, as black recruitment escalates, so too a very nasty localized guerrilla war escalates. Guerrillas, by all appearances, possessed an abiding hatred of unconditional and unapologetic unionists, whom they blame for remaining loyal to the Union even as it waged war on slavery. Some embittered pro-slavery unionists no doubt tacitly and in some cases actively supported these guerrillas in their campaigns, sharing with them a common ideology. At this point, according to one historian, differences between regular forces, partisan rangers, guerrillas, and civil resistance melded and thus broke down finely constructed legal walls. Such was the bitterness surrounding this irregular conflict that even units like the 10th Kentucky Cavalry, CSA, came to be considered a part of a class of outlaws subject to the severe consequences outlined in Lieber's Code, about which you'll hear more later today. Specifically, sections 4 and 5 on partisans and spies. Basically, most raiders and guerrillas, if caught, could be deemed spies and summarily executed, along with any non-combatants who were rendering them aid or comfort. Property could be seized, suspected collaborators arrested, and on occasion, prisoners executed in reprisal for guerrilla depredations, particularly the murder of unionists. As commander of the Military District of Kentucky from February 64 to February 65, Burbridge was on occasion ruthless in his application of this policy, though he proved also to be ineffective at properly coordinating his command and making an end to the costly guerrilla war. Despite their shortcomings, federal authorities sometime took radical steps in their efforts to combat guerrillas, including the formation of mounted units of colored troops, men and horses again. Mounted units of colored troops. At Camp Nelson, the 5th United States Colored Cavalry Regiment was organized for the express purpose of helping bring guerrilla bands to ground, and its companies were also used actively for recruiting black recruits. These units, like anti-guerrilla home guard units, would have to rely on requisitioning for their horses. Military requisitioning was an absolute necessity, but some federal authorities and many practitioners perceived it as a means by which to punish suspected Confederate sympathizers. Policy called for receipts to be written so that Kentuckians who remained loyal to the Union could be reimbursed for their horses at war's end. Despite Burbridge's efforts to police the practice, requisitioning also became bitterly contested. Many Kentuckians cherished their horses. That's a shocker to the people in this room, I know. It mattered little, even to the most loyal owners, that they stood to receive compensation for what may be considered their pets or their prized property. Besides, loyalty among Kentuckians was more a matter of opinion and perception than a discernible fact, as is illustrated by the siblings of the Bullitt family. And I owe this facility to for enlightening me on what I'm about to read, this institution. One of Kentucky's oldest families, the Bullitts, had owned Oxmoor, a sprawling farm in Jefferson County, since 1787. They owned another farm down in Henderson County, as well as property in Louisville. Thomas W. Bullitt, like numerous scions of prominent Kentucky families, had chosen to fight for the Confederacy. He served as a captain under John Hunt Morgan, but he had been captured and imprisoned, first up in Columbus, and then in the officers' prison at Fort Delaware on the eastern seaboard. His brother, Joshua, Chief Justice of the Kentucky Court of Appeals and a Unionist Democrat, remained in Louisville. But in 1864, he ran afoul of federal authorities for his alleged connection to a group called the Sons of Liberty that supposedly was plotting against the Union. Think Knights of the Golden Circle here and the larger conspiracy. His greatest crime may have been his strong stance as a peace Democrat, but nonetheless, Burbridge had him arrested and banished to the Confederacy. He managed to return to Louisville in late 1864, only to be forced by an irate Burbridge to flee to Canada for the duration of the war. While the Bullitt brothers' sister Sue, a self-proclaimed good Union person, described her dilemma in trying to protect the family property, particularly the beloved horses. "You would laugh to see me hiding them one week from the Federals and the next week from the guerrillas." She urged Thomas to proclaim to all rebeldom that they must be saved. "I would give up every possession I have sooner than I would my bays." She also wrote of a boy in her household who had commented that he was glad he was a boy and not a horse. This is an African-American child, only to realize in horror that someday he might be drafted. Dixon reportedly had no other complaints with federal authorities, even when 200 troops from the United States colored troops were quartered in her community. In spite of pervasive raiding, and no doubt in a few cases in order to ensure its continuity, many bluegrass residents protested mightily against federal levies on horses and mules. Further, they were outraged by retributive execution of prisoners, a tactic employed by Burbridge and supported by United States Provost Marshal Joseph Holt, also a native Kentuckian. For example, in July 1864, Captain Merritt was ordered by the Provost Marshal's office to procure two coffins, proceed with two prisoners to the vicinity of Georgetown, and to execute them by firing squad in retaliation for the murder of a man named Robinson in that Scott County community. Holt, in a letter to Secretary of War Stanton, argued that such executions cannot fail to produce the happiest effect in mitigating these atrocities. Additionally, when Burbridge wrote the proposal for organization of the 5th and 6th Colored Cavalry, Holt happily endorsed it. According to the Provost Marshal, these regiments, composed of men also raised, as it were, on horseback, of uncompromising loyalty and having an intimate knowledge of the topography of the country, would prove a powerful instrumentality in ridding the state of these guerrilla bands of robbers and murderers, which now infest and oppress almost every part of it. Burbridge, on the other hand, failed to maintain any sense of control over hiring and enlisting of Kentucky slaves. He also continued to prove unsuccessful in combating the roving bands of guerrillas. In October, the Paris Western Citizen reported an attack on the vital Kentucky Central Railroad, in which guerrillas led by Pete Everett had torn up track and then stopped, robbed, and destroyed the morning train bound south from Covington to Lexington. H.H. Haviland of Harrison County corroborated the paper's account of Everett's attack in a letter to his sweetheart. He also noted, "The guerrillas are keeping us in a perfect boil of excitement." Haviland, his brother, and numerous other citizens of Havilandsville, original name, were robbed very politely, as was the local general store. Additionally, he reported that virtually every single male slave in the community had already enlisted for the USCT. Harrison County, with well over 3,000 slaves in 1860, listed over 600 enlisted men between the ages of 15 and 40. Perhaps Pete Everett was exacting some revenge on this community for letting so many of these men to go off and join the USCT. More sinister was the growing number of murders committed by guerrillas and the district commander's response to them. Again in October, Burbridge ordered, "Hereinafter, no guerrillas will be received as prisoners." This was in effect licensed to kill any and all guerrillas who dared surface in his military district. Those already captive also faced an uncertain future. On October 28th, he ordered 8 guerrilla prisoners to be executed, 4 in Henry County, 4 in Franklin County. November 2nd, he ordered 4 guerrilla prisoners to be shot 9 miles from Bardstown in retaliation for the murder of, quote, 2 Negroes, and 4 to be shot in Woodford County in retaliation for the murder of a Unionist there. These tactics had generated an even more pervasive anti-Union backlash in the bluegrass, and the brunt of this backlash would be felt by the victims of guerrillas and vindictive slaveholders alike. On December 9, the Western Citizen reported that a band of guerrillas had attacked two freight trains on the Frankfurt and Louisville Railroad. Aside from destroying some rolling stock, they attacked a recruiting officer and some 20 black recruits, killing 15. The editor also noted the murder of a lieutenant colonel in the Home Guard in Washington County, apparently in reprisal for Burbridge's executions. Washington County appears to have been all but besieged by late 1864. A member of the 13th Kentucky Cavalry reported, "The guerrillas are around here in several squads committing atrocious deeds of murder of citizens and soldiers. 13 citizens were murdered yesterday in the vicinity of Springfield." Other reports indicated that these guerrillas had cut telegraphs and otherwise disrupted lines of communication in the area. By all appearance, the guerrilla war in Kentucky was reaching a fever pitch as 1864 came to a close. Throughout the winter of 65, guerrillas, including the so-called girl guerrilla Sue Monday, continued their raiding. I won't go into the Sue Monday story because it's just too funny and complicated. Kentucky's guerrilla hunters imposed their own brand of justice. A few days after the LaGrange raid, in which some 35 black enlisted men had been attacked and many of them slaughtered, a guerrilla captain, the notorious Dick Taylor, who was the leader of that gang of guerrillas, was killed in a savage fight with a Home Guardsman that ended in a clash of bowie knives. Black recruits and soldiers seldom received quarter from guerrillas, and numerous white unionists were assassinated. Additionally, several reports mentioned captured guerrillas who were shot while trying to escape, likely meaning they were taken from public view and simply executed. Burbridge had sanctioned such actions, had ordered such actions, clearly exempting guerrillas from the usual protection accorded to legitimate Confederate prisoners. Yet he had also seen fit to continue his efforts to dismantle the Kentucky Home Guard. And indeed, it would be the Kentucky Home Guard that would be somewhat successful in combating guerrillas late in the war. All of this led to the governor urging Lincoln to remove Burbridge. And finally, in February of 65, Lincoln does remove Burbridge from command, replaces him with John M. Palmer. While both Bramlett and Lindsay, who had never been able to establish a legitimate Home Guard, D.W. Lindsay, head of the Kentucky Home Guard, deserve some of the blame for the turbulent state of affairs in the Commonwealth. Still, the Home Guard, with a few excellent companies of guerrilla fighters, had accomplished some noted victories, one of which was an attack on Quantrill and his men that badly crippled that band, and then the follow-up also by Kentucky Home Guardsman Terrell, who was the one who eventually bags Quantrill. Burbridge, for his part, seems to have been more intent with picking political fights with leading Unionist Democrats, including the governor, than working with them to resolve the conflicts. Palmer, a former Democrat who, like Lincoln, was Kentucky-born, Illinois-raised, and now a Republican lawyer and politician, would have his own run-ins with the Bramlett administration. But that's a story for another paper. In conclusion, the change in command in Kentucky certainly did not bring immediate relief for the families of soldiers of the United States Colored Troops. Apart from risk and hardships suffered by refugees and soldiers, women who remained enslaved when their husbands enlisted often paid a heavy price at the hands of vindictive slaveholders. Patsy Leach's husband, Julius, enlisted in the fall of 1864 and became a member of the 5th USC T Cavalry. Though he did not own Julius, Patsy's master nonetheless took his frustration out on Patsy. On one occasion, he beat her with a cowhide for, quote, "looking at them darn nigger soldiers," a reference to the fact she had watched a company of colored troops march past her master's Woodford County home. Her husband, who had belonged to a Scott County resident, was killed in the Battle of Saltville soon thereafter. And once again, Patsy's master turned on her, whipping her on several occasions while expressing his hope, quote, that the last one of the nigger soldiers would be killed. Fearing for her life, Patsy finally took the youngest of her five children and ran away to Lexington, seeking to escape the man she called a rebel sympathizer. Whether true rebel or disaffected Unionist, Patsy's master exemplified Kentucky slaveholders' violent resistance to federal wartime policy, particularly regarding the recruitment of slaves in the USCT.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. I am Brian Alberts, as Dr. Hutton so wonderfully introduced me. I hope to very much build on that foundation regarding the recruitment of black soldiers with what is very much an ongoing project for me. And I also would just like to say that usually I shave for these occasions, but I did promise my U.S. history students that I would be Abe Lincoln for Halloween. So I hope you'll forgive me. The ratification of the 13th Amendment on December 6, 1865, solidified, of course, a fundamental shift in society for the Commonwealth of Kentucky as much as any former slave state. But for Harrison, a newly liberated Kentucky freedman contracting out his and his family's labor that same month, this victory for the rights of black Americans quickly proved a little hollow. Of course, the significance of Harrison's newfound agency should not be ignored, but in many ways, Harrison's relationship with his employer was still highly inequitable. In his agreement to labor on W.H. Wilson's farm for the 1866 season, Harrison would receive as compensation one-third of the tobacco and corn that he produced. Wilson provided the livestock and tools, as well as meat and bread for Harrison and his family, and Harrison's sons, Buck and Jim, would also work on the farm while his wife, Betty, cooked and performed other housework. Their working conditions were less reasonable. Harrison was docked 75 cents for every rainy day that he could not work, while his sons lost 25 cents apiece. It was specified that Betty had to complete all the housework neat and fast, without a word of jaw. They had to pay back double the value of any lost or broken tools. Stealing anything brought a similar penalty at first, while the second offense would earn the guilty party 39 lashes. Upon a third offense, the guilty party of stealing would be shot. Harrison's experience in many ways embodied the trends in labor and race relations that Kentucky would quickly develop in the wake of the Civil War and the ratification of the 13th Amendment. Efforts to restrict African-American prosperity, maintain some semblance of pre-war race and labor relations, control African-American freedom and behavior, and dominate through threats of violence would together constitute much of white Kentuckians' vision for the post-war Commonwealth. The study of Harrison's and other experiences in Kentucky taking place during and immediately following the American Civil War shows that despite the state's wartime unionism, many white Kentuckians felt increasingly alienated from the trajectory of the Union by 1868. This shift was largely the result of the introduction of emancipationist union policies, which forced white Kentuckians to defend their attachment to slavery against the implications and momentum of emancipation, and also to try and shape post-war racial and labor relations in ways similar to other parts of the South. These efforts manifested primarily in white Kentuckians' opposition to the recruitment of black soldiers, and as well as the policies incorporating freedom for their families, for those who served, as well as in public policy debates over both the 13th Amendment and the post-slavery future of black Kentuckians. They also appeared in attempts by whites to control the social and economic conditions of African-American life, as well as in the racial violence that erupted throughout the process of emancipation. The Commonwealth of Kentucky held a unique position throughout the American Civil War and its aftermath, as we've all heard. Kentucky, though its though its pre-war economy was highly diverse, still held the largest stake in slavery of any border state, with about 225,000 black Americans, or 20% of the population enslaved in 1860. Many white Kentuckians had strongly associated slavery with social and racial order for at least a decade prior to the war, and thus were very reluctant to abolish it. Though enough statewide commitment to the Union did exist to keep the state from the brink of secession in 1861, loyalties were sorely strained and an oppositional Confederate government was nevertheless established. Kentucky initially refused to furnish troops for the Union, but it ultimately would supply as many as 25 to 40,000 Confederate and 90 to 100,000 Union soldiers. Unfortunately, the Union's growing opposition to slavery and an increasingly antagonistic relationship between state and federal officials greatly tested Kentucky's relationship with the Union cause. Because slavery was viewed as a control mechanism for the state's black population, emancipation was simply not what white Kentuckians at large were fighting for. Being exempt from the Emancipation Proclamation and the direct Reconstruction policies due to its loyal status, Kentucky managed to stave off the final destruction of slavery within its borders for months following the end of the war. As the work of numerous scholars, notably Ann Marshall, has shown, Kentucky would ultimately find its sympathies aligning with ex-Confederates in the post-war nation. Other factors, such as a strongly antagonistic relationship with federal policy and a lingering military presence, contributed to Kentucky's alienation. But in the end, I argue, it was concerns over race and the destruction of slavery that helped Kentucky identify more with its Southern ex-Confederate counterparts than with the Republican and Union causes. In the decades following the war, Kentucky would adopt strong post-bellum Confederate sympathies through a long process of cultural formation based on competing memories of the war. My work seeks to get between the Civil War and this scholarship to illustrate that the mechanisms which drove Kentucky's white population towards its post-war Confederate identity settled into place very quickly, even before the war's conclusion. Between 1863 and 1868, white Kentuckians' reactions to emancipationist policies in the Union and their efforts to preserve an unequal social and economic hierarchy based on race set them on the pro-Confederate path argued by scholars like Marshall. As Assistant Commissioner of the Freedmen's Bureau, Clinton Fisk gave perhaps the most poetic, if the most damning, description of Kentucky's agitation over slavery's erosion when he said in 1865, quote, "The devotees of the barbarism cling to its putrid carcass with astonishing tenacity." Following Kentucky's short-lived attempt at neutrality, occupation by Union troops began as early as September 1861. The large number of pro-Confederate sympathizers led to harsh Union tactics, as we've heard, including interference with state elections meant to suppress Confederate subversion and influence. Before long, many Unionist Kentuckians felt, though, that they were being treated like disloyal Confederates. Feelings of betrayal only increased in 1863 when General Ambrose Burnside declared martial law and the Emancipation Proclamation was issued by President Lincoln, which freed the slaves within the Confederacy and drastically altered the purpose of the war. A common reaction to the proclamation among white Kentuckians was perhaps best summarized by Edward Winkler, whose collection is just upstairs, a Louisville-born Union soldier serving in the 28th Kentucky Infantry, who stated, quote, "I am totally and irrevocably against it," referring to the proclamation. "It is unjust, it is unconstitutional, and will cause the death of so many brave and true men. Now the rebels have a good and just cause to fight for. What cause have we Kentuckians to fight for?" Not only did this shift in war aims take the Union in a direction that most Kentuckians vehemently opposed, but it also created a large influx of technically free Confederate contrabands into the state and hindered the enforcement of Kentucky's standing slave laws. The practice among state officials to arrest every single black that would travel without passes, regardless of status, led to friction between Union and state authorities. In at least one case, a Kentucky regiment attempted, on threat of violence, to stop other Union regiments from crossing the state line into Tennessee, hoping to search them for black Kentuckians that might have been trying to cross with them. Tensions rose further in the first half of 1864 when the Union began recruiting free blacks and slaves for service in the Union Army from places like Camp Nelson, and also, in consequence, providing them a path to freedom. This path was extended in March of 1865 when the federal government passed a new law freeing the wives and children of any black man who served in the Army. The recruitment and deployment of black soldiers in Kentucky was so controversial that the state government protested and largely prevented it through 1863. The recruitment of black soldiers was often opposed either because it would be ineffectual, according to critics, who would claim that African Americans were either unable or unwilling to work, or because it would lead to armed conflict. One observer worried, quote, "that the Negroes have got arms in their hands and so many notions of freedom in their heads that before the war is over, it is not impossible that we may have to fight them as well as the secessionists." These types of concerns would not significantly change in the war's aftermath. Opposition to black recruitment was no less pronounced in the state government. Statements by Governor Thomas Bramlett in 1865 disputed the constitutionality of the measure and connected it to the trend of slavery's erosion in Kentucky, which he claimed, quote, we could not avoid and for which we are not responsible. That same year, members of the legislature questioned the validity of election results where black soldiers were deployed at voting locations because, as they argued, the soldiers drove away some voters from the polls. Newspapers such as the Lafayette Daily Democrat echoed the types of sentiments seen in the legislature. A report on the presence of black troops in Paducah highlighted their antagonistic relationship with the white population. After recounting the regiment's struggles with a band of local white guerrillas, the article describes the citizenry as held in terror by the military authorities. Other wartime articles asserted the commitment of even non-slaveholding whites in Kentucky to the preservation of slavery and racial hierarchy. When white Kentuckians could not prevent their recruitment, their ire at times could turn to the families of black soldiers. Federal refugee camps received an influx of black soldiers' families who had either been dismissed by their masters or who had chosen to leave due to unnamed, quote, cruel and fiendish atrocities. After the establishment of a rule in 1865 which freed families of soldiers, federal officials were hard-pressed to prevent the forced re-enslavement of black soldiers' families in Kentucky. As these instances show, opposition to black soldier recruitment in Kentucky was clearly associated with efforts to preserve slavery and the racial order that emancipationist policies threatened. Unionist Kentuckians, were being alienated from the Union that they otherwise supported throughout the war. That alienation was no better demonstrated than in Kentucky's refusal to ratify the 13th Amendment. Despite the encouragement of Governor Bramlett that Kentucky accepted the amendment unconditionally, rather than outright reject it, Kentucky's legislature voted down the measure repeatedly and denounced it as a tyrannical usurpation, to which, quote, to which uncontrollable force had compelled their submission, but for which their duty to themselves and their posterity required them to set the seal of condemnation. They would continue this rhetoric months after the amendment was ratified without Kentucky and added to the Constitution. Members of the legislature objected to the amendment on several grounds, including the manner of which it was passed and the legislature's denial of the federal government's authority in the matter. But most of all, the legislature objected to the idea of emancipation that could do anything but disrupt social relations in Kentucky. The legislature passed one resolution which asserted that the Commonwealth itself was the best vehicle for securing the rights of its black citizens. To say nothing of humanity, it stated, the plainest and strongest incentive of self-interest will induce Kentucky to treat her Negro population with perfect justice. To imply through the amendment's existence that Kentucky would not pursue such policies independently was considered an insult. So long as African Americans inhabited the state, the resolution asserted, it was in the best interests of white Kentuckians to maintain good relations with them. The 13th Amendment, it warned, would incite the opposite effect, and white Kentuckians would be, quote, persecuted into hating and mistreating their black counterparts. The massive gains by conservatives in the elections, in the state elections in August of 1865 showed the extent to which these sentiments echoed beyond the legislature itself. The Daily Democrat qualified the nature of white Kentuckians' opposition when it described the amendment, like the General Assembly had, as an arbitrary overextension of power which the states had been ordered to ratify. The amendment was intimately tied with broader claims of usurpation, which, in the Democrats' opinion, gave continued participation in the Union no merit. Such statements illustrate how Kentucky associated emancipation in the 13th Amendment with not only the breakdown of their social and economic order, but also the betrayal of their constitutional vision and loyalty to the Union. But when the amendment passed without Kentucky's support, its white inhabitants were forced nevertheless to contend with the newly freed black population and determine how to shape their post-war social and economic order. In both law and labor relations, the prevailing mindset was that unequal racial hierarchies must be preserved as much as possible. At least one white Kentuckian seemed prepared for some measure of black equality, but maintained that black Kentuckians would lack the education necessary for equal political participation for at least a generation. Others became convinced that black Kentuckians were, quote, no longer the humble servants they used to be. They are restless, impertinent, and discontented. They neglect their work and run off in great numbers. And they acted accordingly, passing a variety of laws which closely resembled the various forms of black codes seen throughout the South following the Civil War. Black Kentuckians were barred from juries and from testifying in court cases involving whites. They could themselves face trial without counsel. Their rights to travel, consume alcohol, own firearms, and other freedoms were curtailed. Strict vagrancy laws sought to control their labor. And also, they were prevented from holding any kind of power over whites via labor contracts. The commitment of white Kentuckians not only to these laws and statutes, but also to the hostile attitude toward African Americans which created them, prompted the federal government in 1866 to extend into Kentucky the jurisdiction of the Freedmen's Bureau. The Bureau's goal, put simply, was to provide advocacy and aid to African Americans in the state, usually in the form of mediation in contract and other disputes. The Freedmen's Bureau offers historians an excellent window into the actual practice of race relations in Kentucky as opposed to legal statutes and rhetoric from newspapers or the legislature. As the unfortunate case of Harrison's labor contract previously described, labor agreements and conditions could be made to resemble much of the former relationship between master and slave. Most contracts approved by the Freedmen's Bureau were much less severe, but could easily contain some disadvantages for black laborers. They also revealed trends not only in the ways that the Freedmen's Bureau tried to improve contract terms over time, but also how white employers in Kentucky sought to undermine or limit the prosperity available to black laborers. Though some labor contracts were fully written out, many contracts approved by the Freedmen's Bureau were actually filled out on forms. The first generations of these forms, used primarily before August of 1865, were quite simply simple in construction and only stated the names of the employer and the laborer, as well as their compensation and the agreement that the employer would provide the freedmen with food and quarters. By 1866 to 67, even more intricate forms had become more widespread, with one variation including the curious stipulation that the laborer be treated, quote, with kindness and humanity. Most styles of contract, however, stipulated that all wages would be forfeit should the laborer leave their position before the expiration of the contract. The final terms of contracts, nevertheless, could vary immensely, even if that simply meant crossing out lines on the forms themselves. In several cases, these edits were more or less benign, such as choosing to pay the laborer monthly rather than through sharecropping, something like that. More egregious changes to contracts might stipulate that the laborer cover all expenses personally. Mostly in cases involving women and children, some contracts exchanged labor for mere sustenance. Contracts sometimes also included less dignifying stipulations, such as Thomas Ellis's agreement to use no bad language and to be kind and obedient to the family of his employer, James Coffey. The choices of typical and desirable terms in Kentucky labor contracts, as well as the evolution in the forms used by the Freedmen's Bureau, hinted at similarly evolving perceptions and concerns regarding the welfare of the employee and laborer alike. The ideas expressed in contracts reflected broader attitudes among white Kentuckians that African Americans needed food, shelter, and care provided to them, and that they would not work unless threatened with the forfeiture of their wages. If slavery itself could not be preserved, hierarchical labor conditions could and would be preserved. Outside of legal contracts, the most effective and tragic vehicles for racial subordination were undoubtedly violence, threats, and coercion. Widespread violence against black Kentuckians was not only documented by the Freedmen's Bureau, but used to justify the continuation of its presence in Kentucky. The Bureau served as a limited shield for freedmen against white violence, and the continuation of its presence was largely contingent on the agitation of white inhabitants. One Bureau official expressed hope that white Kentuckians would, quote, mend their ways once they realized that the removal of the Bureau in Kentucky was contingent on the cessation of violence. Dozens of killings, shootings, and rapes, as well as hundreds of other reported cases of mistreatment, were committed against black Kentuckians to maintain notions of racial inferiority. In its purest form, violent coercion involved simply keeping freedmen enslaved, even as late as August of 1866. In other instances, the employer would simply neglect to properly pay wages, or, in one very curious case, they would pay in Confederate currency. Other acts were even less humane and threatened both the dignity and property of black Kentuckians, if not their very lives. In the summer of 1866, James Rice, a Freedmen's Bureau superintendent in Lexington, wrote to the mayor of the city calling his attention to the recent death of an African-American man. The city authorities, refusing to bury the man in a public cemetery, had completely neglected the body to the point where Rice expressed concerns over the spread of disease. Soon after, Rice's attention would also be called to the forced seizure of a freedmen-operated church in Georgetown by a white pastor who changed the locks and refused access. Rice authorized the local bureau agents to use force if necessary to reopen the church. Worst of all were the physical threats Worst of all were the physical threats and acts of violence perpetrated by whites against African Americans in Kentucky. By far the most significant and pervasive source of physical violence and intimidation were the Regulators, bands of white guerrillas closely associated with the Ku Klux Klan and responsible for lynchings and the harassment not only of black Kentuckians, but also whites who hired, sold land to, or otherwise helped them. Though much of the scholarly attention to Regulators is devoted to the 1870s and beyond, they were quite active as early as 1867. According to a Freedmen's Bureau inspection report that year, which examined central Kentucky near Frankfort and Lexington, Regulators sought to keep freedmen in a state of slavery and enjoyed significant support from the populace in multiple counties around Nicholasville, Lancaster, and Lebanon. Any black Kentuckian who angered the mob by ceasing to work, offending his employers, holding a social party, or any acts considered wrong in Negroes was soon assaulted by the Regulators and either hanged, shot, or unmercifully whipped. The Regulators operated with almost total immunity from local authorities. In the inspector's estimation, the civil authorities were utterly powerless and the jails were simply traps. The Regulators' activity amounted to, quote, a reign of terror. The confluence of this racialized violence, the enforcement of inequality through law and labor contracts, and the staunch opposition that many white Kentuckians levied against emancipationist policies in the immediate post-war era laid the foundations for its subsequent identification with ex-Confederate ideas and values. In creating their vision for their post-war commonwealth, white Kentuckians clung immediately to the putrid carcass of slavery, using its legacy of social and economic hierarchies based on race to swiftly craft legal and extra-legal institutions which reinforced inequality for black Kentuckians. Though most white Kentuckians supported the Union initially, their actions and reactions to the nation's larger emancipationist course set the Commonwealth on a path to which would lead it further and further away from the Union and towards the Confederacy. Thank you.
Again, thanks for the introduction, Dr. Hutton. My name is Jim Pritchard. I currently work in Special Collections at the Filson. I spent most of my career working in archival reference facilities, so I was the gentleman on the other side of the counter working with a lot of you and many of your publications and projects. And far be it from me to make any suggestions, actually, but if you wanted to add sort of an Indiana Jones spin to one of your projects, you might do what I did about 10 years ago. And Dr. Rhine's comments and references on General Burbridge sort of reminded me of this memorable night where I gave a favorable portrayal of General Burbridge of Kentucky to a group about the size of this, maybe a little bit larger, composed of the members of the Sons of Confederate Veterans of Louisville, Kentucky.
That wasn't well received, okay.
Well, you know, I'm not a praying man, but it's kind of a minor miracle that I'm still with you here today. What I'll be talking about for the next few minutes is a lingering war zone, probably one of several, again, as Dr. Hutton's pointed out in his book on Breathitt County, or Bloody Breathitt County, as it's better known, in northeastern Kentucky. For several years after the conflict. And I do apologize. I had the best intentions of having a map of the state of Kentucky. Those of you with a sort of a basic understanding of the geography of the state, I'm talking about the extreme northeastern section, the Big Sandy River, which forms the boundary between West Virginia, and Kentucky, and then, of course, the Ohio River, that southern Ohio tier. So that particular region of the state. Again, I've reached the stage in life where, you know, I remember where I put my car keys this morning last night. I remember where my glasses were. I remember there was a conference today and I was to present. But, you know, beyond things like maps, that kind of slipped through the cracks. If you read some prominent newspapers in Cincinnati, Louisville, some of the major dailies of this region, in the fall and winter of 1861, you would read many editorials, reports from military officers expressing concern about a large Confederate recruiting camp base at Prestonsburg, Kentucky. After neutrality collapsed in the state, Prestonsburg became a major rallying point for the Southern Rights men in the mountains. At one time, it was estimated there were approximately 2,000 volunteers there. They sent emissaries to Richmond, petitioned the Confederate government to send them a commander, equipment, and artillery. And so, again, this particular position was a matter of some concern. There was fear that they might use this base to come down the Licking River Valley, threaten Lexington, threaten Cincinnati, and those points in central Kentucky. Well, a commander was sent, Brigadier General Humphrey Marshall. He was a native Kentuckian, formerly a Whig, who later became sort of a cotton Whig, I guess you might say, on the eve of the Civil War, became a prominent Southern Rights Kentuckian during the secession crisis. And he engaged in a minor campaign in the winter of 1861-1862 against a federal opponent by the name of Colonel James A. Garfield. And this particular little mountain campaign culminated in the Battle of Middle Creek. Not much to speak of, not much to write about. It probably its major historic value is that it sort of helped President Garfield's presidential campaign in 1880 when it was magnified by the Republican Party into an epic struggle. But what this campaign taught both sides is that the region was too remote, too poor, and completely lacking in communications, telegraph, no telegraph lines, no railroad lines. The roads were primitive, and in some places really did not exist at all, unless you would count a creek bed or a riverbed. And so by the early part of the war, eastern Kentucky, and in particular northeastern Kentucky, became a secondary field of operations. Dr. Brian McKnight, in his study of the Civil War in the Appalachian sector of Kentucky and Virginia, referred to a contested borderland between the small, relatively small, regular forces that operated there. But I would argue that for the people, it was more rightly an abandoned borderland. Neither side was ever really able to control the region. Courts ceased to exist. There was no law at the local or state level. And military protection was pretty much scant. Often areas that part of the state would be unprotected for months during the conflict. And Humphrey Marshall would later report that in the border counties of Kentucky, the war is deadly and fiercely waged, although the participants are all mountaineers and their numbers comparatively small. We could talk about some of the operations of regular forces in the area, the cavalry raids from southwestern Virginia, the Confederate base of operations into central Kentucky, or the Union cavalry raids from Louisa, Kentucky, and Mount Sterling into southwestern Virginia, where the South had the strategic Virginia-Tennessee Railroad, the Withville lead mines, and the cleverly named large salt works facility at Saltville, Virginia. Again, you got to love the Scotch-Irish with their way of naming places, just sort of very basically and bluntly. Well, what we'll talk about for the next few minutes is what the late Dr. Michael Fellman referred to in Missouri as an inside war. And this was the little war that occurred in this region among small bands of partisans on both sides. It was a war between Lincolnites. I always wince whenever I hear the term Yankee being used for a border state unionist. In Kentucky, if you look in the contemporary wartime records throughout the state, but again true in the mountains, you were a Lincolnite. I mean, it was a vile insult. You were not only a traitor to the South and to Kentucky, but the implication was, of course, to your race. And, of course, the Confederates were usually referred to as guerrillas, bushwhackers, horse thieves, or horse rogues was also a very common form at that time. As Dr. Ryan mentioned when he quoted a letter from a member of the 13th Kentucky Cavalry, there were squads of Confederate guerrillas roaming at will just in Washington County, Kentucky, in the winter of 1864-1865. Well, in the region I'm talking about, approximately 2,000 square miles, there were also small bands of partisans on both sides. I'll focus just on one. And a real challenge, I think, for any historian doing research on various aspects of Appalachian history, again, are the lack of newspapers, the lack of contemporary reminiscences. There were GAR posts in the mountains. There were United Confederate Veterans posts in the mountains after the war, but very few wartime recollections. And so for me, studying the movements of some of these small bands of guerrillas, I mean, it was literally like an archaeological dig in paper, piecing together everything I could find from county courthouse lawsuits that were war-related, petitions to Governor Bramlett for pardon for war-related acts, military commission proceedings on file at the National Archives. And I was very much intrigued by one Confederate partisan by the name of Algernon Sidney Cook, who operated in present-day Elliott County. Never had much more than 30 men. He operated from the spring of 1863 until late 1864. And he never operated against, like many of others that operated in the area, against what we would call hard military targets. He would generally avoid Union patrols, strike isolated Union residences and farms, would raid a county seat if there were no Union troops posted there to defend it. So I tracked some of his activities in the region, and one of his raids, if you will, that I found in the military commission proceedings, United States versus Thomas Martin, was very typical in November of 1863. The Union forces that did operate in the area usually referred to Cook's men as Cook's devils. They rode out of present-day Elliott County, swept over near Moorhead, back toward Olive Hill in Carter County. They approached the home of Deputy Provost Marshal John Tyree. Most of them were dressed in blue uniforms or blue overcoats because the weather was getting colder. They announced that they were a Union patrol coming back from anti-guerrilla operations in the present-day Elliott County area, and they summoned the Deputy Provost Marshal to the door, shot him dead. Then they seized his younger brother and pistol-whipped him until he told them where the Tyree family horses were hidden. From there, they rode on to the county seat of Grayson and burned and looted every Unionist home in their path. And then before any local force could be raised to pursue them, disappeared back into present-day Elliott County along the upper reaches of the Little Sandy River. Again, Captain Cook was very typical of a lot of the leaders of independent bands in this area. Sadly, he came to a tragic end. He found himself under charges with the Confederate authorities in Virginia. He went AWOL and was shot to death outside a bordello by Confederate soldiers sent to arrest him. His direct ancestors contacted me a few years ago, and the family tradition was is that he was coming back from the Army of Northern Virginia, where he had surrendered at Appomattox, and then was shot, you know, by a local enemy. And it was a hard thing for me to do, but I had to tell them exactly how he actually came to his end. Martial law was still in force in Kentucky until the fall of 1865. Guerrilla bands were still operating in the state through the fall, winter of 65, early 66. John T. Williams, who often joined Cook on raids in this part of the state, was still at large under arms in October of 1865. He arrested the Internal Revenue Officer collecting taxes in Morgan County and forbade him to collect federal taxes. State troops were sent there, but as soon as they arrived in the region, Williams and his men, again, just like any professional guerrilla would do, disappeared into the hills. The state troops were fired on, ambushed at times, but there was no major clash. Across the river from Kentucky in Cassville, Virginia, in the spring of 1866, local Unionists complained to Governor A.J. Borman in Charleston, West Virginia, that ex-Confederate loggers coming down the Tug Fork of Big Sandy would land at Cassville, Virginia, which is across from Louisa, Kentucky, would riot through the town, would hurrah for Jeff Davis. When the local law enforcement officers tried to quell them, they assaulted them. They assaulted Union veterans, and he asked that state troops or federal troops be sent to that particular area. And federal troops were sent to Logan County, West Virginia, in 1867 and remained there until 1869. Again, that's on the Kentucky border. And that's also, of course, Hatfield territory. You know, many of you that are familiar with the Hatfield-McCoy feud of the 80s. So these types of acts intrigued me right on up to a mass lynching in Louisa, Kentucky, in the summer of 1866. Three former members of Cook's Devils were still riding at large. They had murdered a popular Union merchant during the robbery of his store in March of 1866, and a group of, quote, the best citizens, numbering about 150, of Lawrence County, Kentucky, Boyd County, Kentucky, and Wayne County, West Virginia, again, just across from Louisa, took these three men out of the jail and hanged them. And they were all indicted for murder and mob violence, but there are numerous petitions to Governor Bramlett, and each one was more or less the same thing. These men were notorious guerrillas during the Civil War. They listed the names of their victims, some of the local people who were killed. One individual survived an attack, but he described a pretty harrowing account of how in the night they came, broke down his door, broke out his windows, shot his dog as it was cowering between his feet, and then after robbing the place, forced him to his knees and put a cocked pistol to his head. And then only his wife's pleading saved his life. And then they swore as they rode away that if you, you know, warn the federal, or if you report this to federal headquarters, we'll come back and we'll kill you and we'll burn your home to the ground. So again, these were very vivid and very real memories in the post-war years. And I talked about some of the one of the Confederate bands that operated in the region. There was also a Union band that, when you get right down to it, was probably more typical, or more accurately, I should say, a guerrilla band than probably any of the others I've run across. This was the Tiger Valley Home Guards in Carter County, commanded by Captain Alfred Underwood. It usually consisted of about 20 men. He wasn't authorized by the state of Kentucky. He wasn't authorized by the national government. He operated on his, as they used to say, his own hook. And he became a terror to Southern sympathizers in his home county of Carter and multiple counties, Bath, Rowan, all the way over to Fleming. At one point during the Civil War, Confederate cavalry raided Maysville, Kentucky on the Ohio River. The town was plundered. So the disgruntled Unionists of Maysville sent word to Captain Underwood's headquarters in Carter County. He rode into town with his men, and they robbed all the Southern merchants that had been spared during this initial raid. What intrigued me about this particular band, and again, I'm talking about one band of post-war marauders, among many. However, these were the guys that grabbed the headlines, you know, all the way to the New York Times, everything else. This band continued to operate. I found evidence of them on a horse-stealing expedition into West Virginia in the winter of 1866, 1867. Jesse Underwood, a lieutenant of his brother Alfred, shot and killed a former Union officer at a circus in Bath County, Kentucky in the fall of 1865. That Union officer had been assisting the Bath County sheriff in an effort to serve a war-related warrant for arrest on Underwood, and instead Underwood shot his way out and escaped. There were numerous indictments against the Underwoods that were filed during the war that were still open on the docket in various Kentucky counties, and there began to be numerous indictments against the Underwoods in the years that followed the war. They became so notorious in their neighborhood that by 1873, neighbors banded together to form a vigilance committee. It was headed by Squire Holbrook, a native of Virginia. He had been a Union man during the Civil War, but I believe he was a member of the Democratic Party, again, kind of a Union moderate at this particular time. And when he formed this vigilance committee, that made him a mortal enemy of the Underwoods. Efforts were made to obtain pardons for the Underwoods. They told that we can be pardoned for our wartime acts. We'll go back to peacefully farming. We may even move out west. And as many petitions that were sent in their behalf to Governor Bramlett, there would be just as many petitions from respectable, loyal Union men saying, don't pardon the Underwoods. The Underwoods don't deserve executive clemency. All of this continued into the 1870s. Alfred Underwood saw the handwriting on the wall, and he and Jesse went to the West, some say Kansas, some say Nebraska, some say Iowa, in 1874. Alfred never returned. However, their father, old George, their brothers William, Elverton, John, and Dave remained in Carter County. Their home was known as Fort Underwood because it was a fortified cabin that they constructed during the war against to protect themselves against guerrillas. Now it was a really wonderful form of protection against officers of the law. In 1877, some horses were stolen in the vicinity of the Underwoods' home in neighboring Lewis County. They were tracked back to the Underwoods by the Stamper family, and a pitched gun battle occurred on Laurel Creek in June of 1877, with men being wounded on both sides. The Stampers allied with the Holbrooks. They called on the local officials for reinforcements. They laid siege to Fort Underwood. The Underwoods were reinforced by some of their former wartime colleagues, including John P. Martin, who would later become notorious. Some of you may have heard of the Martin-Tolliver War in Rowan County. Really was the bloodiest, quote, feud in Kentucky history. He would lose his life in that. And then also James Claiborne, or as he was more fondly known, Old Clabe Jones, who was also a Union scout and, quote, bushwhacker in the mountains during the Civil War. And I know we're probably cutting close on time. I just want to digress. A lot of these things intersect. And, you know, I've described some pretty rough and brutal individuals. But Clabe Jones, I found, you know, did have an appreciation for family values. And I wanted to stress that these men were not entirely, you know, brutal. I found him in the 1870 census of Elliott County, Kentucky, with his dear wife, their children, his dear old mother, and a young woman servant. And then a few houses down, I found him again with the young servant and their children. And I think Glenn Beck and other conservative commentators would agree with me that these are the kind of family values we need to bring back as our society. There was a serious gun battle at Fort Underwood. The Stampers, the Holbrooks, the local law officials were driven off. The governor sent in state troops. The state troops forced those Underwoods that had not fled into hiding after the fight, the old man, one of his wounded sons, to come with them to the county seat. There was a trial in a magistrate's court. Again, in Kentucky jurisprudence in those days, that was usually the first step to see whether an indictment should be handed down by the grand jury. The Underwoods were acquitted. They went back to their fort. And then things seemed rather quiet for another few months until Elberton Underwood was assassinated while working in his fields in the summer of 1879. Jesse Underwood came back to defend his family. The feud broke out again. And in a matter of weeks, the Underwoods were virtually exterminated. Jesse was gunned down at Fort Underwood. His other brother, William, was shot to death through an open window while dining with his family. Squire Holbrook lost his life being shot from ambush. The governor did not send in state troops. He sent in a member of his staff. He said, there's no use to send state troops now because the Underwoods have virtually been exterminated. Old George was bedridden with multiple wounds. He allowed some masked men to enter the home because they wanted to prove that Jesse Underwood was dead, and they shot him to death, you know, eliminating the head of the Klan. Well, what happened next, briefly, the governor's aide said, there's no need to send troops. I think local law enforcement can handle this. Well, what happened in the next 2 years was the largest vigilante uprising in the history of the state, the Regulator Uprising, 1879-1880. Hundreds of vigilantes, tired of these types of marauding bands that continued to haunt the mountains after the Civil War, rose up and ran individuals out of the county, lynched several other individuals. They even got into people who violated local moral values. If you were a lazy husband that didn't support your family, that you were flogged. If you were considered a lewd woman, you were driven out of the community. So it covered all kinds of, quote, social and criminal problems in the area. When it finally ended in 1880, there were at least 800 members just in the counties of Boyd and Lawrence alone. So that'll give you, when we talk about a 5 or 6 county region, that'll give you an idea of how widespread this was. So I've shared this narrative with you, and some of the things that I would want to propose and maybe trying to get a better understanding of these events. Well, one was simply this. You know, because this was an abandoned borderland, and because men on both sides were more left up to themselves to defend themselves, protect themselves, I think a lot of individuals on both sides realized how fragile the laws and government were, how easy it was for a small band of men, a dozen, but heavily armed, supported by a kinship network, supported by their old veterans in blue or gray, to ride and continue to engage in what really amounts to organized criminal activity. You see the same sort of scenario with the James Younger gang in Missouri, and the Underwoods more or less adopted that same cloak of protection. We were good Union men during the war. We protected this region against guerrillas. Now we're being persecuted by ex-Southerners in the courts. If you just pardon us, well, you know, the Jameses and Youngers said the same things in Missouri. Something else that, you know, maybe you could help me here, I haven't seen explored in depth, is what you might call the militarization of the home in the aftermath of the Civil War. I was going through a military commission proceeding for an individual, a guerrilla that operated in this area. And, of course, the questions from the judge advocate general were, how were these guerrillas dressed? Did they have a uniform? How were they armed? And a lot of the witnesses said, well, they carried war guns. And they weren't referring to pistols. And the judge advocate said, what do you mean by that? They said, well, big band guns. You know, we have squirrel rifles and shotguns in our homes here in the hills. But we don't have, you know, infield rifles. We don't have Belgian muskets. Well, after the Civil War, bands like the Underwoods, you know, would ride with 4 or 5 automatic, you know, repeating pistols, and Spencer carbines, Henry carbines. Again, these were sort of the military assault weapons of that time. So I think that that's something to consider as well. Finally, in his work, Savage Conflict, Daniel E. Sutherland proposed that guerrilla warfare was one of the main reasons behind, or a major or important reason behind, the collapse of the Confederacy. Once the Confederate government could no longer control a region and it lapsed into a sort of a guerrilla, cauldron of guerrilla warfare, local citizens realized that Richmond couldn't protect them. The Confederate Army couldn't protect them. You know, why should I risk my life for a government that can't even protect me and my property? Well, what I would propose is also this. People in this abandoned borderland in northeastern Kentucky at the end of the war, I think, also lost their faith in local and state and federal government. And so after years and years of continued marauding, continued depredation, they rose up and took the law into their own hands. As I said in my paper, they continued to keep their weapons by their sides long after the war. Thank you very much.
All right, I just have a few remarks to make about all three papers, and then we'll move on and hopefully have some time for questions. And if somebody back there can be my timekeeper, if Mark or Glenn or somebody could give me the high sign if I'm going over a bit. I knew it. All right. There's an oft-quoted quip about how Kentucky actually seceded in 1865 rather than 1861. And, of course, this it probably came from the historian Merton Coulter. And of course, this can come off as a very glib, unhelpful bromide if not placed in some sort of historical and political context. To be clear, Kentucky did not actually secede in either year. But after the war, its white majority did make decisions that demonstrated its kinship to states further south rather than those on the other side of the Ohio River. Again, a number of decisions that were not necessarily inevitable, nor were they necessarily instinctive either. At the same time, Kentucky's experience was unlike that of the seceded states in some very important ways, and in some ways quite different from its fellow border states, too. For all white Kentuckians talk about the depredations of the federal government in the second half of the war, it is difficult to see the Jeffersonian doctrine of state sovereignty as their central concern, as it supposedly was in other slave states. The 19th century South was a place in which states were supposed to matter above all, and Kentucky's wartime experience suggests that its physical location between North and South mattered more than its actual statehood. Furthermore, its egregious record of bloodshed before and after Appomattox was symptomatic of struggles for very local things, farms, counties, and people, rather than larger principles. These three papers read in conjunction demonstrate how Kentucky in the Civil War era was paradoxically a very southern place, but also difficult to place in a broader southern story. Mike Ryan's paper addresses this paradox head on. In fact, it sort of embodies it. The picture he draws is one that is rarely drawn in front of the public, or at least the non-academic public. An honest, thoughtful attempt to understand what it meant to be pro-union and pro-slavery, a combination that most 21st century Americans might not know existed in 1863, let alone would they choose to ponder it for very long. It just doesn't fit into the dualities of North and South, slave and free, that dominate the larger story, and of course for good reason. One of the great ironies of the Kentucky War experience was the Union sought to employ slave labor for infrastructural improvement, even while many of its officers were becoming the tools of slavery's very permanent demise. And of course, with the construction of that attempted railroad route down to Knoxville, that's a good example of that. Of course, slave-owning Kentuckians might not have seen it as much of an irony in August 1863, when many still felt that slavery might yet be saved along with the Union. Rather, they saw it as an imposition which belied their own sincere support for the Union and showed what they considered the federal government's lack of appreciation for that act of loyalty. Once many of these slaves were mistaken for Kentucky freed people, they were accidentally manumitted, a condition that was never inevitable, but probably seemed so by the last year of the war. Ultimately, the position of this pro-Union slaveholder was untenable, while the institution itself died a death of just under 1,000 cuts. One has to wonder at the gradualism involved in killing an institution that most Americans associate with absolutism and extremism. It seems that for all his lack of finesse and skill in maintaining control over a Union state, it was probably General Burbridge himself who saw the big picture, realizing the battle in his assigned state was ultimately more political than martial. And at the same time, during a civil war, the distinction between political matters and military matters could become moot very, very quickly. I have one simple question for Mike that he can answer at any time of his choosing. What might the plight of the slaveholding unionist and the plight of his current or former slaves mean to those today who try to dissociate the Civil War from slavery? Seems to me that wartime Kentucky could simultaneously provide them with ammunition while also complicating their basic premise beyond all proportion. The mind boggles. Next, we have Brian Albert's paper, which picks up where Dr. Rhines leaves off, taking a much broader view of Kentucky during Reconstruction and what has been called readjustment. He also, perhaps unintentionally, provides us with another rare insight into the viewpoint of anti-Confederate slaveholders. The differences in fact, this was something that was in the paper that he ended up not including in the spoken part, I believe, the part about how slavery was maintained in Louisiana for the sake of getting the cotton crop out, and in a way that the USCT policy was not enforced in Louisiana quite the same level it was enforced in Kentucky. And obviously, Kentucky farmers saw this as an imposition because you cannot grow cotton in Kentucky, and yet they had been loyal unionists. And you have these rebellious plantation owners who were allowed to use potential soldiers as slaves as the war continued for quite some time. Like it or not, Kentucky unionists had somewhat of a point when they looked to the South and to the way Louisiana was treated. However, this should not disguise their main motive of maintaining a labor force based upon unfreedom, cotton or no cotton, and Albert shows how their actions, legal and extra-legal, between 1863 and 1868 reveal this. Regardless of forms of agriculture, black citizenship was simply unacceptable to the majority of white Kentuckians. Alberts agrees with Douglas Edgerton's primary assertion in his recent The Wars of Reconstruction in demonstrating that white resistance to the rights of freed people began very soon after the war, not only after the federal government grew weary of enforcing Reconstruction on up in the 1870s. Former slaveholders knew that political power for former slaves would translate into the loss of their hierarchical labor conditions that had fattened them for decades. And this is what motivated their feet dragging against the conditions of Confederate defeat. But I have to wonder something I wondered when also reading Ann Marshall's recent book. Did enforced white supremacy necessarily mean longing for the Confederacy ultimately? Or make one, as she called them, a belated Confederate by, let's say, 1868? Clearly the Confederacy and the commensurate lost cause narrative meant something to white Kentuckians down the road. Perhaps more by the end of the 19th century. And, of course, Kentucky was still electing former Confederate officers as governor as late as 1911. However, its refusal to ratify the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments did not necessarily make it Southern or Confederate. After all, both New Jersey and Delaware initially refused to ratify the 13th Amendment, but neither ever adopted any sort of nostalgia for the Old South or the Confederacy. Both Delaware and Maryland rejected the 14th Amendment, and when they did the same for the 15th, a few years later, they were joined by California and Oregon, two states with no history of Negro slavery and no valid fear of the effects of black citizenship that still, at least initially, saw a danger in it. And if I'm not mistaken, California didn't actually ratify the 15th Amendment until well into the 20th century. In short, not all of the faithful Union states were on board with the plan of emancipation that we now permanently associate with our Civil War, yet New Jersey and Oregon hardly fit into the model of ex-Confederate ideas and values that white Kentuckians eventually adopted within a generation after the war. For that matter, violence against black Kentuckians under the guise of the Regulator title, that of the Ku Klux Klan or what have you, were also similarly political and not necessarily sectional and not completely limited at all to the former slave states. You would have seen the same thing in 1866 in Pennsylvania, in New York. Indeed, African Americans in the North were also victims of these sorts of political violence. My question would be, was the Confederacy the only available model for this in the memory of white Kentuckians? If white supremacy was their primary concern, could they not carry such out as loyal Americans, not just as fictive former Kentuckians? And I would suggest you also include the fact that Kentucky did produce a lot of Confederate soldiers as well, unlike, say, Delaware or Maryland, and certainly not New Jersey. Finally, we have Jim Pritchard's portrait of a section that was seemingly cut off from the larger, more often addressed narrative of slavery, emancipation, and then white counter-revolutionary resistance to same. With these first two papers, we see narratives that place Kentucky within a larger Southern story of war and Reconstruction, one familiar to anyone who has read the book I mentioned earlier, Ann Marshall's Creating a Confederate Kentucky, as well as the various books on the individual experiences of the Deep South or the other border states. The common denominator is a history of violence carried out in the interest of maintaining white supremacy. However, the Underwood Gang of northeastern Kentucky provides us with a version of the war and its aftermath that modern-day white Kentuckians are oddly more comfortable with. This was a series of conflicts with very little, if any, obvious racial significance, since aggressors and victims were almost all white, and since occasional victims sometimes became aggressors themselves, i.e. a so-called feud. This is a story that runs the risk of creating a moral equivalency, or perhaps better yet, an immoral equivalency, since there seems to be no good guys and bad guys among these former Unionist Confederates who patrolled the hills of northeastern Kentucky for decades after the war, as late as the 1870s and perhaps after. If we don't look too close, they appear to be men without politics, only knives and guns. Although we as students of history should know better, men with guns always have political opinions behind their trigger fingers. Nevertheless, it's easy to believe otherwise. This was why it was so easy for disinterested observers from New York City or Louisville to call the resulting violence a series of blood feuds rather than the political detritus left behind in the wake of the largest war in the history of the Western Hemisphere. It was easy to tell half-truths about the Underwood Gang, their abusers and their victims, but Jim has shown that it is very difficult to get the whole truth as to what motivated men like Jesse Underwood and what undergirded their initial unionism and how a defender of a local community becomes a brigand and an outlaw in relatively short order. It's just my curiosity, but when viewed from a comparative perspective, these former guerrillas and home guards seem to have compatriots all over the world in dozens of different wars. As Stathis Kalavas, I believe that's how his name's pronounced, showed in his monumental The Logic of Violence and Civil War, the kind of wars these men experienced is more an experience rather than an actual action. And you could see analogs in places like 1930s Spain, 1960s Vietnam, and of course Iraq in the 21st century. The idea that war has come to a definite end is a rosy fiction enjoyed and propagated typically by elites, while peasants and Montagnards are left behind to pick up the pieces for generations. And I think that's a condition we definitely see around Boyd County, Kentucky. It is easy business for outsiders looking from a great distance to misidentify contingency for inherency and jump to the conclusion that places, not people, cause violence. To say that a particular place, whether it be Carter County, the whole Commonwealth of Kentucky, or all of the bloody, bloody United States is violent is inherently fallacious, since places do not commit violent acts, people do. The same can be said for a particular span of time, although it's very common for us to say that a historical period was notably violent or notably peaceful. This is, in a nutshell, is what led to the misunderstandings Americans have had about eastern Kentucky to this day, as well as the larger expanse of land we call Appalachia. One of my most basic final suggestions is now that we have the bluegrass and a portion of the eastern plateau handled by these three papers, the story of western Kentucky during the war and during Reconstruction could still do with a bit of elaboration. This is a state of sections after all. Beyond that, I'd encourage something a bit broader for these scholars to consider whether or not their findings fit into what's coming to be called the Long Civil War thesis. The contention that 1865 was only the ending to a particular phase of what might be considered a continuing war. Many Americans will not find this idea very satisfying, since the pageant of white masculine surrender and reunion that we see on a spring day in Central Virginia still tugs at our heartstrings and satisfies our sense of region balanced with nationhood. But if we look beyond this frankly elitist narrative and poke around into the coves and farms of the Bluegrass, the Cumberland Plateau, and perhaps many other places in the United States, we discover a much less comforting series of stories that followed after Appomattox, all of which can be construed as warfare. It was probably the American experience with Vietnam that motivated historians to come to terms with our own war's dependency on guerrilla terror. Perhaps our country's more recent wartime experience might currently persuade a newer generation of scholars that while wars often have clear beginnings and long middles, their true and absolute endings are almost impossible to trace. Now let's have some questions. How much time do we have, Mark?